everybody. Welcome to Upstaging, a podcast made for theater people by theater people. My name is Drew.
I'm Adrian.
I'm Jeremy.
And on this week's episode, we're going to be talking about Company, the 2006 production featuring Raul Esparza. And welcome back to Upstaging.
All right, excellent. Oh boy. I am very excited about
this. I'm so glad we have to talk about this.
I'm so glad you do. Welcome back to the fold. Well, not back. Welcome to the fold. Well, maybe in a previous life you loved Company. Probably everyone does.
If you guys listened to last week's episode, which was late, that was late, a cowboy song, which was Adrian's pick.
It was also pretty late.
We figured out halfway through the show at one point because somebody made a Company reference.
I did.
And then we were like, oh, we should talk about that. And Jeremy was like, I haven't seen Company.
What's Company?
And I lost my mind because it's my pick for this week. And I was like, I had something else planned, but that goes out the window.
Just out of curiosity, what was the thing you had planned?
It was Property Rights by Alan Hale.
Oh, yeah, I remember you talking about that.
It's a really funky science fiction piece, and we might do it later on in the show.
Next time, maybe.
Because it's fun, but I mean, Company, that's one of, if not my favorite musical, so that's got to take precedence. So, that being said, Jeremy, what did you think of Company?
Yeah. Oh, God, it was just so good.
Right.
Oh, my God. I love the staging. We watched the one with Raul Esparza. Mm-hmm. Yeah. What was this? Revival of
2006.
2006 revival. I believe that's the only revival of it.
On Broadway, yeah. Because the 2011 one is a concert.
It's a New York film on a concert. If Justin ever had a quiz on Company, we'd know that there's just one revival.
one revival. Oh, my God. It was just amazing. Mm-hmm. He did not seem like a leading man, but he was.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
He's not what I think of when I think of the character of Bobby.
He's very short.
Yeah, he just kind of looked like more of a leading man type. You know, I don't know who else would play him. Who's the guy?
Neil Patrick Harris.
The guy who originated Alder Price.
Oh, Andrew Reynolds.
I could maybe see that.
He has a more youthful energy, so I don't know if it really works for that
he's
sort of like
show, but
midlife crisis feel. Mm-hmm. He could be like, yeah, one of the other guys.
But absolutely.
Maybe like Aurelio Butts would be great as Bobby.
Mm. But he was just great, and the show overall was just lovely. It was not what I expected it to be. I originally thought, for whatever reason, it was about a business company.
That makes sense.
I think that's a good segue right into the plot. Adrian, you adore this show.
I do.
Do you want to walk us through just kind of the feel? Because there's no real plot,
but there is
a story.
It takes place over the course of about a year or so, and just this guy centers around Bobby, who's this guy in his mid-30s, and he's single. And he is friends with like five married couples.
Yeah. Yeah. It's 10. There's 10 of the people.
Oh, yeah. I forgot Joanne. Anyway.
Joanne.
And it's sort of like his sort of like love-hate relationship with relationships and with trying to settle down and get married and move on with his life and that part of his life. And
How do you make a show about that? That lasts at least an hour.
Vignettes. There's no like chronological plot. It's all skits.
Yeah, little scenes, 10 to 15 minutes on average, I'd say.
I think I was talking with Drew about this earlier. The show starts on Bobby's birthday, and it also ends on Bobby's birthday.
Mm-hmm. And intermission, there's a Bobby's
and
birthday.
And I had a theory, personally, but we could talk about that maybe as we get a little bit farther
on. I had a theory that it all took place on the same day.
No, you thought it was the next year. I thought it was the same day.
Well, now I changed.
And then you change it, and you were like, oh, no, I changed,
and now Drew's right.
All of it's the same day?
We'll talk about it.
How did he get to all these people's houses on the same day?
That was in his conscious.
So, in this particular show, we start with all of Bobby's friends are showing up. They're throwing him a surprise party. It's his 35th birthday, mm-hmm. which it's kind of like, I guess that's the significance of like a midlife crisis. Like you should know what you're doing at this time. You should know, yes, I want kids. You should know, yes, I want to be married. You should know these things. And he doesn't. And I feel like that's kind of the significance of that. But the first scene, the scene at the start of the second act, and then the very last scene after being alive, which we'll get to the score in a second.
Oh my goodness.
They all are Bobby's birthday, and I think. And so the first one is they're showing up and they're he's like, thank you all for coming, blah blah blah, and they respond not listening to him. So he's like, thank you all for coming. And they're like, there's the birthday boy. And he's like, I love you all so much, blah, blah, blah.
You don't look it.
Yeah. Like, they're not listening to him at all. So, and then at the end, they're like, well, nobody showed up. What do we do? And they just leave, and they end up leaving him alone. And then he smiles and blows his birthday candles out. So I thought that the first scene is actually him imagining exactly what's going to happen. And then the final scene, he actually doesn't show up to that surprise party, and he just leaves.
Interesting. So you're saying that the first scene and the last scene take place are sort of like the same time. One of which is imaginary. But you don't think that all of those vignettes...
No.
Okay.
No, I don't think you really need them to happen in any chronological order or at a specific time.
Yeah. Those could actually
But
even
then
be...
what about that middle birthday?
I think that's just a framing device. That one is in particular is a framing. It's a leading into side-by-side.
Okay.
Because I think he's also...
A different birthday?
No, I think he's thinking about... Because with any Sondheim... By the way, this is by Stephen Sondheim, you know, the god of musical theater.
Right. Yeah.
Until Lin-Manuel Miranda takes his throne, but...
Give it a couple of years.
Sondheim worked for 50 years. Give Lin-Manuel 50 years. He'll get there.
Yeah.
But I think that the middle one is him... The first one is him realizing it's like, my friends, they don't care about my birthday. They're not going to listen to me. And the third one is him, you know, my friends are pretty all right. I actually love my friends. And then he goes through and he starts to figure out what he actually wants. And then he's like, I love my friends. I need to think about myself for once. And that's what leads him into this final scene. That's my theory anyway. It might not be right at all. I haven't read the script.
I don't know. I don't know if I gel with it. I just see, I think all those birthdays are actually happening. I think... this weird relationship that he has with his friends, they sort of all weirdly idolize him, and he sort of almost relishes that role, but is also kind of turned off by it.
Why would they be jealous of the position that he has being single,
right,
if they're trying to ease him into a relationship? They're always saying, why don't you settle down?
It's this weird paradox where, like, half the time they're like, don't get married, man, you're the best. And then half the time they're like, I met this girl, you should totally be with her. Double date and blah, blah.
If we're talking about, like, a clear objective and what all these characters want, I don't know how I feel about that. I don't know how I feel about these characters flip-flopping opinions on him and what he should do. I don't know how truthful that is.
I think that's kind of the point,
yeah,
to be honest with you. I think because you have... So, for me, you got to contrast, and we can talk a little bit about the score. There's the third, I think, song in the show is this piece called Sorry Grateful, which I think it's Peter, which is one of his married friends, his husband. He asks him, hey, are you ever sorry that you got married? Bobby asks Peter this. And he sits there and he tells him that you're always sorry, but you're always grateful, and you always wonder what might have been. And I think when Sondheim and George Firth, who wrote the book, when they're talking about relationships, they're saying that it is always uncertain, and you always want to not be in it, but you always do want to be in it. And I think them flip-flopping is kind of what humans do. I mean, we've all been in relationships, and you know there are always moments that are, and I think all of us have lady friends who listen to this. So, you know, this is not a dig on you. We love you all dearly. We think you're wonderful.
Harley.
And I love you too, Tira. And Jeremy, he's in like with you, Claire. But there are always moments where you're like, you know, being single is fun because it's not a commitment, because you always nobody likes having commitments. Nobody really likes that. Mm-hmm. But deep down you end up realizing that this commitment is important and you do want to have this commitment, and you do always kind of flip flop on these relationship things. Again, not saying we don't love our significant others, because we do, but I think that's what they're trying to say with that, as far as flip flopping.
Yeah, I think one of the best, there's a point where I forget the name. I mess up on all these people's names because they don't say the names very often sometimes, and it's just next other person. But just one of the husbands in the group, he says, is like, wouldn't you like I love being married. Like, this is the end game. This is what I love. But wouldn't you like to be single for like an hour?
I think that's David.
David and
that's the one where they smoke weed.
Yeah. And Mary is his wife?
I think so.
Yeah.
I think.
I don't know. It doesn't really matter. They're different. They're just different people. It could be like Machina, where it's just like young woman, young man.
I mean, the one that really matters is Joanne. I mean, we can talk a little bit about the different characters in this show. I mean, Bobby is, of course, your protagonist. He's your main character. But I mean, out
Joanne
of
Joanne and Amy, are Amy really the sticks most, out the most. That yeah.
So Amy is this really frazzled individual who is she is not married yet, but towards the end of the first act, she gets married to her husband,
Paul.
That is yes, that's Paul. Mm-hmm. And she's she's afraid of this commitment.
And she sings the single fastest musical theater song of all time,
that
except
was,
for Guns.
Sorry, everybody.
But the thing is, technically Guns and Chips is probably faster, but Guns and Chips is much shorter, and Daveed Diggs gets to take a breather every time they say Lafayette.
Either way, yeah. she was fantastic. At least the one we saw in the Raul Esparza one, she was just she was like on her knees and like on her hands and knees trying to like hide away from her husband, yeah. And she was begging to the audience.
It's one of famous Sondheim mental breakdown songs.
It's which one? I'm not getting married
today.
Go check that out. And it's her. She's like, I'm leaving. I'm not going to get married today. And then she ends up backing out of her.
Thanks for coming, but I'm not getting married.
Yeah, she ends up backing out of her marriage and says, "Don't, we're not doing it." And Paul leaves. And then Bobby asks her to marry her, and she sits there and she's like, "You want to do what?" And that kind of like jumpstarts her into like, "No, wait, yes, this is what I want. Paul is what I want."
Mm-hmm.
And she leaves and goes, yeah, and gets married with him.
And the big thing she says when she first decides to not go through with the wedding is, "I'm sorry, Paul, I don't love you enough." And it's like sort of like this sort of a like the idealization. Like she was like too idealistic about what she wants. She's like, there must be something better. Who knows?
But then
I can't lock myself down. And then, but when confronted with Bobby's naivete,
mm-hmm,
then she's like, no, wait, this is right.
She says,
and then immediately afterwards, Bobby sings,
Marry Me a Little
about this ideal relationship, mm-hmm, where it's like, we'll make this commitment, but it won't be like so deep that neither of us will feel trapped.
Mm-hmm. You know, I mean, at
we
the
don't
end
have
that,
to give up a thing. We'll stay who we are, and it's like that's exactly what Amy just learned not to do, but Bobby hasn't quite learned that yet. He thinks he's having some great revelations.
She says at the end of that scene before she leaves, she's like, "You have to love somebody,
not just somebody."
And
which
what's really cool about the show overall is that all of these couples are at different stages.
Mm-hmm.
And how each one of the stages of their marriages have differing effects on Bobby. For instance, what was a couple that said? Bobby was all like, "Oh, you guys are great together."
Oh, the divorced couple.
Exactly.
I don't remember that. Yeah.
You guys are great together, and the wife is all like,
"No,
if you decide to leave her, man, I want to be the first to know." Well,
you're the first to know. I'm sorry, what? It's a great scene.
Yeah, we're getting divorced.
Truly, Company has the single greatest book for a musical.
He wrote Merrily Roll Along.
Mm.
Yeah, that scene was pretty great because it was at the very end of a marriage. However, it was interesting because they decided to stay with each other in the household. They're
like they were still,
well,
they
I have a
still
job
like,
and a household to maintain. I'm not going anywhere.
Yeah, and they still like loved each other, and they literally say it's like, we're more married now than we were ever were when we were married. Which was like this interesting. It's like, so what even is
marriage? Like, it's almost like marriage
is
the important part of a relationship.
Yeah,
which I think that's the point of them.
Yeah,
I think each character is trying to teach you a lesson in a different way.
I mean, and I know that we're young and everything, I don't think that we're planning on getting married anytime soon.
Right.
But what does that make you think about marriage in total? Like, is it a label that induces a lot of stress? Is it a trust?
I can kind of speak to this a little bit. I had this girl I was dating a while ago, and I remember at one point, because I was young and stupid, and we brought up marriage for whatever reason. And this is in high school, and you know, you don't even know what you want to do in college in 2 years, much less for the rest of your life, right? And I brought up at the time, I was really insistent. I was like, "I want you to take my last name if we ever get married. That's really important to me. I want you to do this." And she just wasn't into it, you know, and then finally, that ended up being a big fight, which is a dumb thing to fight about, you know, but
right,
I've grown up in a lot of ways, I realized it was like, the important part is not that they take your last name or you have this slip of paper. The important part is that you come home every day and you're like, "I love you. And I love you forever." And I think that's that relationship, the divorced couple. That's
mm-hmm.
what they're trying to say, is that it doesn't matter. That slip of paper and that title, that's not what's important. It's that you come home every day and that's still who you love. That's still your person.
So don't think that, you know, a marriage can make you have this undeniable and unconquerable love Mm-hmm. You know, just a slip of paper doesn't give you that. You have to have a genuine connection with a person.
Clearly, and Joanne, mm-hmm. I think Joanne represents as well.
Yeah.
You want to talk about Joanne? Who wants to talk about Joanne? Because she's important.
I mean, the thing is, a lot of Joanne's importance comes at the very end.
Very end of
the
show.
So I don't know if I want to talk about her.
Right before the most beautiful moment in maybe all of Broadway.
Yes. Yeah, that's a great, the Lady's Lunch is great. Mm-hmm. Then, I mean...
And the scene afterwards.
We'll get to Joanne. Joanne is, she's an old, we'll talk about her importance later, but we should mention her.
She's been divorced a couple times. Some self-esteem
this
issues
is her third
and
husband,
a lot of complaints about the generation gap.
She's on her third husband
and an alcoholic.
Now. So she's the oldest one, and she's on her third or fourth husband now.
Sort of like the weird, eccentric mentor of the group.
Kind of. She's the divorced Yoda, if you will.
Bitter
Yoda.
I was kind of afraid that her character... Okay, by the way, the actress who played her reminded me so much of Jane Lynch.
Barbara Walsh is the actress's name.
How do I not know that?
And Jane Lynch would be great in that role if they ever revive it. Broadway people, if you're listening, revive it.
Company.
Put Jane Lynch in it.
Yeah, boom.
Put us all in it. Yes. Put the three of us in it.
Who'd be Bobby in
Norbert Leo Butz.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah, sure. Or, who do we like? Who am I? Who do we like enough to?
Who do you? Like? What do you like?
Brian Darcy James is probably a little too old.
Brian Darcy James.
No, maybe. I think you could do it.
You have to look 35. Yeah, Brian Darcy James could do that.
How old is he?
That would be.
I don't know.
I think he's in his early
40s. He's 40 something. Quick to Siri. Hold on.
How old is Brian Darcy James? They even got that.
Brian Darcy James is 47.
Wow.
He could do it. He looks fine.
He could do it. Or if we're going something
wrong. We could do it. We could do it.
Again.
Okay. Thank you. I got that. As a mashup.
Cool.
That's what that was. So I think now's a good time to talk about the score.
Yes.
I mean, this is by far. I'm so hit or miss with
it. I want to mention a fun fact.
Go for it.
Company was 1970? 70. Yeah. And for some reason, that specific Tony Awards, they decided to separate the best score category into best lyrics and best music.
Huh.
But then Company just ended up winning both of them.
Oh, that's awesome.
So now it's all one.
So they just, that was, I think that's the only year they did that.
Yeah.
Like, they split it, and then Company won both. And they're just like, well, that was useless. Let's just put it back.
Yeah.
I mean, it's like, you're trying to what? Take one away from me? I'm just gonna take two now.
So now it's mine. So for that year, he has two instead
of
just one.
Two.
Sorry,
yeah,
Broadway,
awesome.
That was dumb.
I think he's won six Tony Awards for best score. I think.
Wow.
He's which is three times as many as anybody else.
Yeah. I mean, you can't deny he's a genius, and I'm very hit or miss with some of the stuff. Like, maybe we haven't listened enough. Like Sunday in the Park with George is mm-hmm. That one's never sit with me.
I understand.
Even though
I can listen to it. And I'm like, this is good, but it's not like it doesn't grab into my heart the way that Company does.
The way that Assassins does not pass my danger zone
what,
test.
What we were talking about in Justin's class.
Test. The danger zone test. The danger zone test is you listen to a song. No. You listen to a song, and then you immediately listen to Danger Zone by Kenny Loggins. You know, which is one of the most catchy songs of all time.
Right.
If you can remember the first song's melody, it has passed the Danger Zone test, and it's worth listening to.
Interessante.
If it does not, if you can't, if you still can't hear Danger Zone.
Not every musical is... is memorable, but it can still be good.
Yeah,
oh,
still,
sure.
Like, for instance, like,
oh,
Stephen, for instance, Sondheim's, Sunday in the Park with George, we were talking about it in Justin's class. It's, you know, it's, what makes that music so impressive is how precise it is.
Yeah, well, all of Sondheim's stuff is very, it's,
yeah,
everything
that one
is there for a reason.
That one in particular because of, you know, things that are related to paint and,
mm-hmm.
and dadaism.
Pointillism, yeah.
Dadaism.
Yeah, dadaism, nice.
Pointillism, but, but yeah, I think that all in all, that it was a great score and Company and
yeah.
one of his best in my opinion.
I think it is his best.
I mean,
I'm biased because that's my favorite Sondheim show, but like I don't know, I get very
hit or miss. I think it's objectively the best score. Objectively the best musical maybe ever made. So
I couldn't pick another.
It is an undeniable fact that Company is the best thing ever that the human race has ever created.
Now,
so,
can we talk about
suck on that, anthropologist.
Can we talk about one of the most important and powerful songs in the show that is so memorable that I listened to it 15 times since I
is
first watched.
Is it Being Alive?
It is Being Alive.
So
being alive.
let's set that scene a little bit. So that means we can talk about Joanne as well, because
yeah.
this is the second to last scene, and so in the second to last scene, we'll be fine. So in the second to last scene, Joanne. She sings this song called "The Ladies Who Lunch," where she's essentially like calling out all of the BS that people go through. She's like, everyone, you're so full of it. You are so full of crap, and then at the end, it's like, and you know what? So am I. Mm-hmm. She sings about herself and how bitter and annoyed she is.
Yeah. It seems like the first couple of verses are about the sort of younger generation and all of the bullshit that they do to sort of try and keep...
Well, now we have to mark it explicit, Adrian.
Stay in society, sorry. And then she turns it back on herself, and it's just so good.
Yeah.
Like, ugh. And it's... And she's just... She's, and I really love the choice for this particular production. Just that ending note, it just kind of becomes this, like, this shout into the void, and the music kind of stops before the actress is done singing. Yeah. And so she's still just sitting there. Like, you'll have to listen to it to understand, or watch it, because the pro shot video of it is in the UNCG library. It's on DVD. I highly recommend you watch this thing. The actors play their own instruments.
I thought that was John Doyle.
John Doyle. He also directed The Visit on Broadway. It was his most recent
and
Broadway
He also directed the most recent revival of Sweeney Todd.
Yeah,
with Michael Cerveris.
That was a little bit before Company.
That was in like 2004 or 2005, something like that.
Yeah.
But
I'm sure Company was probably a little bit easier to adapt to his style than Sweeney Todd was.
But in that scene, after she sings that, she just sits there and stares at Bobby. She just stares at him while he talks. In a sense, it's almost like therapy, in that he just sits there and talks and talks.
Can I be honest?
Yeah.
That whole maybe 2-minute moment was the most intimidating I've ever felt by an actress ever.
She wasn't even in the room with you.
She
did it, you know, like,
and it's not a scary
10 years
moment.
Ago.
It's not like it's like a horror moment. Like
I was actually worried
she
was gonna do.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So finally, she talks about this point, and she all of a sudden out of nowhere, she tells Bobby to like come over, and we'll
to basically to marry her.
Yeah, she's like, come over,
or at least to have sex with her.
Yeah, and he
and he's like, I'll take care of you.
And he responds, well, then who will I take care of?
And then she's like, there you go. That's your moment. Did you just hear what you said? That's your turnaround moment. And he doesn't believe it. Yet.
So he's like, what do you get? What do you get out of marriage?
What is the point?
Yeah. And everyone starts saying that the Bobby, baby,
like, if there's a musical theme, that theme is everywhere. It's in the background of Another 100 People. I think it's in the background of just about basically every song.
Yeah,
every major moment, all of the ensemble, all of his married friends are singing it at him.
And finally, he yells, stop!
Yeah.
He screams at them to stop, and then he walks up to the piano.
By the way, in this production, the revival, that was the first time he's touched a musical instrument.
Besides the kazoo.
Oh, besides the kazoo.
Well, still.
The kazoo's a joke.
Right.
And he walks up and he starts playing his own music. Instead of being accompanied, he plays his own music. And he sings, I would argue that it is the best piece of musical theater ever written. Mm-hmm. I mean, I'm counting
that's
opera.
That's a huge statement.
That's like 1700 to now, and I'm saying it's the best one written. It was in 1970 by Stephen Sondheim.
Better give me some backup.
It's, well, so being alive is what is so powerful about being alive for me, and I think, and Adrian can probably, he'll hop on the bandwagon because I think he agrees with me in a lot of ways. In being alive, he talks about, you know, what marriage isn't at first. He's like, it's somebody to crowd you with love. It's somebody to force you to care. Somebody to sit in your chair. All it is somebody to just force you to do all these things.
To change you, to push against you, to mold you. It's not comfortable.
It's not. And then all of his friends are sitting back there, and instead of telling him what to do, all of his friends sit back and they're like, want something. You're so close. You're almost got
it. It's better living it than looking at it.
And he just does another verse of where it's somebody to crowd you with love, and it's so much more.
Oh, yeah, I love that, the line. Don't be afraid of what it'll be. Just be afraid.
The only thing to be afraid of it is that. It won't be.
Yeah, don't be afraid of what it will be.
Right.
And he keeps going until finally he has this moment. It's this, and the switch flips for Bobby. Literally.
Mid-song.
3 minutes before the end of the show, in the middle of a song. We've just sat through 2 hours and 25 minutes of this production. And the switch finally flips for Bobby. And he realizes, this is what I want. Yes, marriage is this. Yes, relationships are. It is too much, and it is somebody who wants too much of you, and it's somebody who asks you more than you should ever have to give someone. And you know what? I want that.
And did he take upon that epiphany very lightly?
No, it's violent. Especially Raul Esparza's performance of it. He like screams, like the make me confused, mock me with praise. He yells it because I think he doesn't want to accept it until that but alone is alone. He has a line where he says, but alone is alone, not alive.
And that's the film.
And I think that's the switch. I think that's where he kicks and he's like, yes.
It's like he's been going through the whole play, sort of snide, making smart remarks, not really speaking a lot, sort of almost sort of like, I think, I mean, if I was playing Bobby, just sort of feeling dead and kind of, he talks about having depression and being kind of depressed.
I think everyone else wants to live through him and he just lets them. That's exactly what he does for the entire
and
show.
And so he's just kind of he's just kind of shambling. Like even in earlier in the show, You Could Drive a Person Crazy, they talked about how he's kind of he's a zombie.
Yeah.
He's just sort of shambling through, not really his own guy.
Not living his own life, but only experiencing it vicariously.
He's sort of like, it's almost as if all his married friends have created this persona for him, and which they talk a lot about in Side by Side. Like, if you're playing Bobby and you do that thing like, what do I say about me? What do other people say about me? You get like pages and pages and pages of what other people say about you because people are talking nonstop about Bobby the whole show. But it's all something that has to do with them. And it's all sort of trying to project what they want onto him.
He takes care of our kids. He flirts, but he isn't a threat.
He's the buffer between me and my wife.
Mm-hmm.
You know, he'll keep her occupied when I want to sleep.
Yeah.
You know, and so it's interesting that they all kind of want to see him in a relationship. But I think if and when he actually like does get married and like sort of abandons them, like realizes that he needs to move on from them, I worry about them.
Yeah.
Like, if they made a company sequel, I think a lot of those people are going to have some very hard truths to look at without Bobby there.
And you're assuming that Company 2 would exist in a universe where Bobby actually ended up finding that love.
Yeah, a Company 2 could be him, like, knowing that he wants it now, but still not being able to find that person who fits it. And he's late. He's kind of late to the party. He's mid-30s now.
Mm-hmm.
You know? And that
that scares him.
That anxiety is definitely in him. I mean, in the Act 1 finale, I forget what it's called, actually. Someone is out. Someone is waiting.
Someone is waiting.
Someone is waiting. Have I waited too long? Did I know her? Have I waited too long? Maybe so, but maybe so is she. It's like, that's part of his head. He's trying to be optimistic in that moment. And that, I love that song because it sounds like it should be a finale song because he's like, someone is out there, I'm so ready. We'll be out.
We're doing okay?
Yeah, we're doing good.
We'll be out just a second.
Thank you.
We're almost going to get kicked out again, guys.
we're cutting it close, yeah. But it feels like a finale because according to Bobby, it should be the finale because it's like, you know what? I am ready. But I'm ready for this perfect woman. I'm ready for this absolute perfect woman who will be like this amalgam of all of my friends' wives, which is so weird.
But then at that moment, at the end of that song, he's like, wait for me, hurry, wait for me, hurry. I'll be there if I can, wait for me, hurry.
Yeah.
He doesn't want that yet. Yeah. And I think he knows that. So that in his mind,
like,
that
wait
is the
for
finale.
Me, I'll hurry.
Yeah.
But he's not, he's still dragging his feet.
Yeah.
I talked about this last week when I brought it up talking about late, but this show is all about this grown-ass man finally actually maturing.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's powerful stuff. And then being alive, I mean, I cannot express to you why I love this song.
It's deceptively simple.
There's so much
life inside it, so much behind
it. It has to be done. Honestly, even with the enunciation of the words and what vowels and syllables you stress, I did not personally enjoy Neil Patrick Harris's rendition because he crunched his words and I didn't hear his vowels and it didn't feel as powerful.
Well, I think
it was such a shame.
But it's also not as controlled an environment because it's a concert and there's like a bazillion piece orchestra behind him, so maybe
and a bazillion people out there.
Part of it is part of it could be like the sound is getting kind of eaten.
And but in contrast, but
whereas with Raoul, the set that John Doyle has created is very, very contained. It's like this square with like a column and like some clear blocks, and then the piano, and it's everyone's dressed like they're at a funeral, which I thought was interesting because, you know, you sort of have that old cliche of like, oh, you're getting married, I guess you're dead. You know, it's like I think that's Oklahoma, Get Me to the Church on Time, that song. Is that in Oklahoma?
Maybe. You might be right. It's one of those shows.
And like at the end of that song, they like carry the guy away and he's got like a lily held as if he's dead, but he's getting married. And it's like, everyone's like, ha ha ha, you get married, it's the end of your life. Yeah. And I think they were trying to evoke that sense.
And it's just, but it's and just,
but it was subtle and yeah. it wasn't.
So like everyone is wearing black, but like, everyone is wearing a very different kind of black. So
that's a great costume designer.
Yeah, Joanne's dress is black, but it's like reflective and shiny. Whereas
Amy's is, it looks like it's a wedding dress, but mm-hmm, it's black.
But it's black.
Marta has like these gorgeous leggings that are sort of fishnet, but like sort of like a lace type deal.
All the guys have variations.
Have we talked about the ex-girlfriends at all?
No, I briefly mentioned You Could Drive a Person Crazy, which is sung by them.
We should, because then we could talk about another 100 people as well, which we have to talk about.
Yeah.
Bobby has three ex-girlfriends or current girlfriends.
Depends on where you are in the chronology.
It's Amy,
Kathy,
and Marta. Yeah.
Saxophones.
And Amy is a flight attendant, and she's a bit out there. She's interesting.
A bit flighty, a bit...
I see what you did there.
Hey, boom. A bit light, I guess. Not particularly confident, but very sweet.
Yeah, and then, whereas Kathy...
For those of you who've been here a year or two, when I wanted to do a company workshop, I was thinking Rachel Isaac. So, if you know Rachel Isaac, she went to Disney school.
Okay, cool.
So,
yeah. And then, so there's Amy. There's
Best
also
of luck, Rachel, wherever you are.
If you're listening, we love you. I've never met you, but I'm sure you're cool.
You don't know about this thing. I don't know.
And then there's Kathy. Kathy is a former flame who he wanted to marry, but couldn't get it up.
Right. Because he wasn't really ready.
Yeah, he's not ready until even the end of the show. And I don't know if
he would have been the most compatible with her out of anyone.
Yeah, because he's like, we wanted to marry each other, and why didn't we?
Yeah,
and then
that scene, they knocked that scene out of the park.
Yeah,
so great.
Like, out of the Sunday with
like
party,
yes,
party
like
with George.
Oh yeah,
right out of the grunge shot. Mm-hmm. Yeah, but in that scene, like, it's during Another 100 People, which is the most New York song to ever New York.
Which, and then we'll get that when we talk. And when Marta is the other third ex-girlfriend, and she's a hippie. I mean, she's hippy-dippy,
she's,
as all get out.
She's very eccentric, very, very positive, very outgoing.
Youthful
she
vibe.
Is a, she, if tie-dye was a person.
Maybe.
That's who Marta is.
A tie-dye at a punk concert.
I know that, again, I had this idea for the company workshop, but it fell apart because no one can play that music.
Yeah.
I asked Brady Weiss, and I could see the fear run through his eyes, and I was like, don't worry.
Never mind.
But Victoria Pittman would be a perfect Marta. So if you want a sort of analogy, I guess, or a comparison to make.
And she sings this song, Another 100 People, which it's describing New York. And it's like, another 100 people just got off of the train and got off of the bus and got off of the plane.
Love that. Another 100 people.
So she sings this verse. He has a scene with Amy where he talks to her. Another verse about another 100 people just got off of the train. Then he has a scene with Kathy, another 100 people. Then a scene with Marta.
What's the purpose of the 100 people?
I think
just
it's
to show just...
the world keeps moving. Everything
keeps
going.
New York
going.
Is like a heart.
And people go in and are pumped through and shit, and then they come out, and then they go in and are pumped through and shit and come out, and like people are leaving, but a million people are leaving each day, but they're replaced by another million every hour. And
it's saying
just,
that, like,
and it's like, oh, there's another 100. Oh, there's another.
Nothing matters.
They're gone, and there's another one.
Nobody matters, but you matter. At the same time, it's that weird paradox of New York City, in that nobody in this city matters, but everyone in this city matters.
And, like, that song has this chaos, but it feels like there's an order within it, and it's just, it's so perfectly New York. Like,
it's so Sondheim-y.
Like,
yes.
A lot of people think that New York, New York by Sinatra is the most New York song, and they play it at Times Square. That song is about the promise of New York. That song is about, it feels like it's by someone who has not been to New York, is imagining what New York is like and the sort of ideal of New York. Another 100 People is New York.
It's the inner
and
the
I love
gut.
It so
it's
goddamn
so good.
Much.
It's and it's I mean the music and the vocal line do not go together at all, and it's
mm-hmm.
beautiful.
And so it makes it incredibly difficult to sing.
What a bitch.
One thing I love, I watched the Seth Rudetsky Mm-hmm. Burdett's
the is that the guy who does Chatterbox?
I think so.
Yeah.
I don't know. He does Broadway radio stuff, but he does like deconstructed musical theater songs, and I saw him talk about it. And apparently, in the background is something I didn't notice until he mentioned it, is that later on in the song, you hear the bada, 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 and it's in the background of another 100 people.
Isn't that creepy?
It's just like all of these stories coming together and like making some sense in this
grid. Which is what New York is. That's exactly what New York is. Yeah. And that's what people are, is it's a story and another story coming together to form this new story.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, man. That's poetic. I need to write that down.
Got some final thoughts, guys?
Oh, man.
Go for it, Adrian.
Watch this freaking show.
Watch
it. It's the best thing. Man, I don't even, I don't know. Like, what do you say?
I'm going to be super poetic and gross.
Yeah, well, go for it.
I'll just talk until I say something mildly profound and then pat myself on the back.
Then I have to follow.
That's how I go through life.
Company is... It no matter if it was written 45 years ago, I'm sorry, 45 years ago, and it is just as poignant today on what a modern relationship is. Yeah.
The only thing that dates it is they talk about busy signals.
Yeah, which is like, what's a busy signal?
Yeah.
Look that up. Do your upstaging homework.
Yeah.
but it is what a relationship should be and what it's not. And it doesn't, like we talked about with Late last week, is that it gives you a problem and it doesn't tell you how to feel. It just shows you and lets you make up your own mind. That's another big strength of George Firth's book and Sondheim's music, is that it gives you these, this is what a relationship is. This is what it is not. Deal. Yeah. And then in Being Alive, it, even at this finale, it doesn't tell you what to feel. It just tells you, this is what it is. And you know what? That's what I want, for better or for worse.
Yeah.
Like, they, you know, when you say your vows, for better or for worse, sickness and health, this is what I want.
This connection with another person, this partner, to try and so that we can limp together and lean on each other through this ridiculous rat race.
For like a final thought from me, from a playwriting perspective, I think everything that needs to be said about this show could be summed up in, and composing is could be summed up in Being Alive. I think that it's just the connection to a such a simple problem and seeing all of the magic and beauty and horror that you could pull out of this one simple idea can be something so beautiful if executed properly. Mm-hmm. You can take something so small and expand it until it feels like it's a balloon that's about to pop, and then it does, and you love it.
Mm-hmm.
And you just sit back, and that's where you sit back, you see what you saw, you stand up and you start clapping.
You wipe yourself off.
I cannot promote that song enough. And I mean, if Stephen Sondheim were still with us, I mean, I would like want to just talk about that song for hours. I think he is.
He's not dead.
He's dead.
What in the fuck? No, he's dead.
Look it up. Sondheim he's totally
is
dead.
Sondheim.
Hold on.
Sondheim is still alive.
Song on the still life?
I found this on the web.
Okay. We're going to see if Stephen Sondheim. We're going to see if
he's
an idiot.
He's making a new thing.
Is he?
He's writing a new musical based on absurdist French movies.
Really?
Yes.
I thought he was dead.
He is not dead.
I hope he is so that I can antagonize him about
the late Stephen Sondheim is something we would have heard.
I mean, he's old.
He
was born in like 1930. Oops, this is iTunes.
Let's see if he's actually... Oh, you're looking up Nephites. That's fun. Mormonism.
Okay.
Please be alive. That'd be super cool. Oh, he's not dead. Sweet.
That's super cool.
He is 85 years old.
Okay, so he's like Mel Brooks in right.
Like, I'm not prepared for the day where I'm gonna get the Google alert or whatever that he's gone. I'm not ready for that.
I hope
it doesn't happen for like at least another like.
And Mr. Sondheim, if you're listening.
Stay alive. That would be enough.
Good Hamilton reference.
Thank you.
Seriously, go listen to Being Alive, and if that does not, I mean, touch your soul and just gives you this honest truth of what relationships are.
You should watch the whole show.
Watch the show. It's absolutely worth your time.
You will cry. I cried.
It feels like it shouldn't quite work. Because this show changed the game. It's like a contemporary realism musical, which hadn't really happened before that. It was like, it was a musical where it wasn't like a story of like this fable or like this larger than life story.
And this is before, I mean, your Les Mis's and your Phantom of the Opera and your Big Rivers. This is before these just big, like, buoyant stories. This is before that. So it still has that directness and poignancy that I love so much.
And it just told this real story with music. And the stretches in between songs sometimes are a lot of words, but it never feels like, oh God, when's the next song? Or, oh God, how long is this song going to last? Every single moment is interesting and poignant and tells a story in and of itself. And you don't want it to end.
This is absolutely my favorite piece that we've talked about on Upstaging by far.
Mm-hmm.
I would, if I had to forget about every piece we've talked about on the show and
except
keep one
it company,
I would do it all the time.
Sorry, Barnum.
I think we. Sorry, but yeah, we
you
love
know
you,
what,
Psycho.
You know what? I accept.
You yeah. I think
accept.
We are going to get kicked out soon, so we probably need to call this an episode. Any other things you guys really want to talk about?
What are we doing next week?
Next week, Jeremy, come closer to the mic. You gotta.
Next week, guys. Hey, get out your legal pads, because we're going to be reading 12 Angry Men.
That was such a train wreck.
That was
something with get out your switchblade and stab them into the table.
Tickle your bailiffs and
so what? You heard it here first. We're talking about 12 Angry Men next week. That's Jeremy's pick. I'm excited to read that, actually. That's gonna be a lot of fun.
Movie,
she
play,
watched,
everything.
Yeah,
we can do both. Why not?
We can do both.
Volcano Los Dos.
We can do both. It'll be fun.
That's another dream.
But anyways, guys, that was Company, and we will see you next week on Upstaging.